Hello.
Hello, Greg.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to talk to you.
Good.
First of all, I have to thank you so much for the recordings you sent to me from Salisbury with Ian Anderson.
Oh, good, good.
Those
were
wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Thank you. It was a really fun thing to do, you know. It was a strange experience, I have to say, to sort of show, you know, singing like that in a rock and roll context, in a cathedral. You know, it's a place where people, of course, usually, you know, creep around silently, and there's candles burning, and, you know, the place is 600 years old. And it's a, you know, there's this sort of reverence people have in there. But, you know, it's full of dead bodies and everything, and all of a sudden there's this rock band performing in there. It's really peculiar. But it was nice, and they like, you know, the audience liked it, and we managed to raise a bit of money.
Who else played there? Who was in the rock band?
It was me, Ian. I can't remember who the three guys were from his band. There was also the guitar player from my solo band, which was Florian Opale.
Florian's played with Ian also.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, how's Valentino Boy doing?
He's good, yeah, no, he's good. He's a good boy.
Good. Glad to hear it. Oh, so I'm getting excited. Your tickets for your show, The Songs of a Lifetime, they're going on sale out of my neck of the woods this Sunday.
Good, good.
And I don't know how much you want to tip your hat as to just what to expect at the show. You, when we last spoke, you told us about Lucky Man and that how that came to be. And
you know, a lot of these songs have got stories behind them, and I've, you know, what it is, I'm writing an autobiography at the moment, which I hope to have completed in time for the tour. And when I was writing it, or while I'm writing it, I still haven't quite finished it, but while I was writing it, it was obvious that throughout my life, certain songs have become very important, or were very important to me. And not only songs that I'd written, but also songs that had influenced me by other people. And they kind of tell a story in and of themselves. And in most cases, there is a story linked to them, which kind of affected my life in some way or another. Or the destiny of the way that I went musically, the direction I took musically. And, or some songs were pivotal, you know, in that way. And I think what it is it just occurred to me that when you collected all these songs together, with all those stories, it really, it made a really nice concert. You know, and I thought of how best to do it. And, the idea occurred to me of, because the book is a sort of solitary thing, it's my account of my life, I thought it would be a good idea to perform a show like it. And I came up with the idea of Songs of a Lifetime.
Well, it's brilliant. I really don't recall anyone else doing anything like it.
It is a strange concept because even though, I mean, it is essentially me playing and singing, I don't want to give too much away about the show because part of the beauty of it will be the surprises that occur in it. And so I can't really go and tell you everything about it. Otherwise, you come and see the show, you know what's going to happen. But I think a lot of people will be quite shocked at what it'll be and how it'll be. There'll certainly be some surprises in there.
Wow.
And also, the other thing that interests me about it is that this is a road, this journey I've been on for the last 50 years. You know, I've shared with so many people. All of those people that are in the audience have lived with that music all through their lives. So we've kind of shared it together. And I think it's a wonderful idea to sit down with those people in an intimate room and share that journey with together and allow them, if they want to say something or ask a question or, you know, be involved in some way. I think that's a good thing. And It's a lovely thing for me to actually be able to talk to the people who've been on this journey together with me.
Just the idea of more exciting surprises happening during the show. That should be... Just can't wait to participate.
Well, I think, you know, it'll certainly be entertaining, and there'll be things that are unexpected, and some things that you will, you know, that people know me for, that, you know, I'm obviously going to play the hits that people want to hear, because that's part of what they come and see me for, but there'll be a lot of things they would not have heard and would not know about me, because I've just never told these stories before. And so, for anyone interested in King Crimson or ELP or in British rock music from 1960, I suppose, from 1965 onwards, it's kind of interesting.
I know that's... my area of music that I'm most interested in. So yeah, you've got me. I'll definitely be.
And the thing is, you know, people know what happened on the sort of front end of it. They know that ELP played at the Isle of Wight and California Jam and all the rest of it. What they don't know is the stuff that was going on behind the scenes and out of the public eye and all of that. And that's the story that I'm going to try and tell. And not in a, I'm not, you know, it's not going to be one of those kiss and tell books, you know.
Right.
But it will be the story of what happened, behind the scenes, I think it's right to say.
I think anyone that knows you would be shocked at a kiss and tell coming from you. That's not your style. That's not who you are.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. I think, you know, it's you know, fun for people to hear about gossip and drama. But basically, life's about much more than that. I think we really, the audience and myself, we shared so many years of happiness and of concert going, and they were great years, positive years, and I think that's the side of it that I want to share together with them.
I was out of the store shopping last night, and I was stopped by three different people. Did you get to talk to Greg Lake this week?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting for me being on the radio.
Yes.
People don't know my ugly mug, and still... Hey, that's Bill Snyder. He knows Greg Lake.
So, yeah, I think it's because I'm becoming a bit of an antique, you know.
Oh,
as you go on, you become rarer and rarer, you know. But look, it's lovely, you know. It is lovely to know that people still care, still buy the music, still interested in how it got made and why it got made. It's a wonderful feeling, and it's a real honor for me. And that's why I feel this loyalty and this kind of willingness or want to actually share time with the people. Because had it not been for them, I wouldn't have gone on the journey at all.
Right, you would have been by yourself playing music. Yeah.
In my bedroom, you know.
Right.
I mean, it was those people that made it possible for this to happen. And so I think that's it's just great that we can all be together and celebrate it in a way.
Now, what was it like as you transitioned from writing songs in your bedroom and your scrap in a notebook to realizing people are listening worldwide and being greatly impacted by your music?
You know, it's a strange thing, but there's very little space between the initial idea and the end result. You know, music is something quite magical. It passes through the air. It's quite invisible. It passes through the air from the soul of one person into the soul of another, you know? And that is the amazing process to me. It's how that happens. You know, that I can have a feeling, and with music, I can convey that feeling to another human being. That the miracle of that always amazes me.
That is...
And it's that that keeps me, you know, active in music. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to share.
That is magical, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, one day, I'll tell you a quick story. It was a man called Chris Blackwell. He owned a company called Island Records. They were U2's label, King Crimson, ELP, Joe Cocker. The list is endless. Chris Blackwell said to me, he said, you know, the day the music business changed was when the invention of the Walkman. He said, because before the Walkman, people used to sit around a record player together and share. They played an album, and they would all listen to it together. But after the Walkman came out, music became a solitary experience, a lonely experience. You listen to it with your headphones on and alone. And that, to me, I still love the idea of shared music, you know? Of enjoying music together. I think that's a wonderful thing. It's the same as going to a restaurant and eating on your own in a room.
Right.
It's much better when you go and you sit with some friends around a table and have a laugh and tell stories and you enjoy it. Or your family. And as opposed to sitting in a room on your own, eating a takeaway meal or something, you know. There's the difference, and so I love shared music.
Gosh, I've never thought of it that way, but that was a very pivotal transition point in how we enjoy that medium.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And, of course, along with it, when we used to share the album covers, you know, as you were listening to the record, you would share the album art. So a lot of people were becoming knowledgeable about graphical art, about pictorial art. So not only were you sharing the music, but they were sharing a sense of appreciation for the visual arts as well. Album covers like Brain Salad Surgery, you know, were done by the artists like Giger, who did the film The Aliens. And it gave people this appreciation for the visual arts. I mean, not just King Crimson, although they had a fabulous album cover. The original King Crimson was a fabulous cover.
Indeed it was.
Again, during those early days of rock and roll recording, there was, I think the idea of sharing music was just very empowering.
It's very sad in a way to think of the way music is going in the future, all digital and... You don't have the album to flip through and the album cover art to enjoy.
Well, you know something, I think you may find that changes. Nothing stays the same. And I think there was a recent survey done when audiences want to become more proactive. They've discovered that audiences are keen to become more proactive and more hands-on. And I think they, in some way, they miss this experience of being involved, being so close to the music. They used to be closer to the music. Loyalties to a band would be unbreakable, you know?
Oh, yeah. I remember in high school, there were... The Yes fans and the ELP fan.
Yes, that's you know? Right.
And how dare you like whatever side, yeah.
Or, as ELP used to call them, maybe. We used to call them maybe, and I think their pet name for us was Henderson, Snake, and Charmer.
Oh, I'd never heard either of those before.
Yeah, there
wonderful.
You go. But actually, you know, funny thing was, I lived with Chris Squire. Chris and I lived together for a while, back in the early days when he was just forming Yes.
No kidding.
And I was, I think I was still in King Crimson. And Chris and I lived together in London in a flat. And although he denies it, that's where he started to use wah-wah strings.
Okay.
He always says that I copied him. But he knows the truth.
Okay, well, the next time I talk to Chris, I'll ask, but I'll tell him.
Yeah.
I know the true story. You can't put it over on me.
Please please send him my regards when you speak to him.
Oh, I will, definitely.
Yeah.
I guess he's looking for, or just got a new singer for Yes Again.
Really?
Yeah, it sounds like Benoit got sick and he's recruited someone else, another tribute singer.
Well, it's very difficult because people get to, they know that, the identity of a voice, probably even better than they would the identity of a musician, an instrument player, you know. The voice is so identifiable and it's so hard to replicate it because, you know, if you sing someone, you know, especially in the context of trying to stand in and replace somebody, after all those years with John Anderson, you know, for somebody to stand in and replace him, it's not easy. It's a character. It's a persona and a character with it, you see. It's not just the sound of the voice.
Exactly, yeah. That was one of the things when I saw you at the Orpheum Theater a year and a half ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you covered, you sang some of the King Crimson songs, I Talk to the Wind, in particular, just stands out of my mind, to where I had the recording all these years of the boy doing the song.
Yeah.
And then to see you do it as a fully mature man, and your voice
changed. That's the beauty, I think, is reflective.
Right.
It's reflective. But what you were hearing is the same voice, you see.
Exactly.
And so even though my voice has changed over the years, it's bound to have done, you know, but I'm still the same person. That interpretation that you heard was the same interpretation that I did originally.
It was one of those moments that just kind of sent shivers down my spine. Oh, my God. Not a song that I've actually listened to too horribly often.
No.
But then, oh gosh, what a gem that was.
Sometimes as well, I think, when you hear songs from that era, you realize the quality of the writing compared to today. I don't speak for all music, but the standard of writing back then was very high. You know, you had to be original. That was the currency then. Originality was the currency. It wasn't how well you could conform to market trends. It was, you know, could you be really different?
Right, generate your own market trends.
Yeah, and be identifiable. I mean, you know, I've said it many times, but if you play any record by any band from that era, you put on a record by Jimi Hendrix, within 3 seconds, you will know who you're listening to.
Definitely.
The Pink Floyd, the Rolling Stones, all those bands, you will know within seconds who you're listening to because the identity is so strong. Nowadays, I get to the end of a record, I don't know who I've listened to. A lot of times, you know. And of course, there are exceptions, and you know, there will always be great, great artists. But whether they're given an honest platform is another matter.
A lot of that has to do, also, you mentioned Island Records. There used to be so many small record companies.
Yes.
And just like radio, with the conglomerates, now there's so few small record companies.
Right, you see. This is where the whole thing used to have this individuality, and acts were nurtured and all of that. So it was a totally different world. And personally, you know, when I look back on it, I mean, I don't say it much. I don't talk about it much because I don't want to sound like one of those old farts, you know. Oh, he was better in my old days, you know. But the truth is, I believe, that it was better.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Music was more vibrant. It was more exciting. It was more important. The lyrics were better. The lyrics said something. You know, you'd often hear songs with so much truth in them. Nowadays, I can't remember the last song I heard that had the same sort of power of meaning as, say, something like Imagine by John Lennon, or I don't know. But, you know, songs seemed to be written better back then.
Oh, most definitely. I've shared with my audiences, I won't bore you with it right now, but at a real pivotal stage in my life, when I was just 18 years old, I had a very huge decision to make as to something I was going to do. And it was one of your lyrics that steered me down the correct path.
Wow.
I was down that path. I ended up meeting my wife, I mean, it was life-changing. I mean,
unbelievable. Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, you know, you'll often hear people say, you know, oh, I heard that song. Well, I've had people come up to me, you know, Bill, and say, one guy came up to me one day and he said, I was about to commit suicide. He said, I was a heroin addict and I decided to end my life. And he said, I'd written this letter to my family, and he said, I had it all set up. He said, I had all the drugs, everything was there. And he said, I'd come to the end. He said, I couldn't carry on. And he said, as I was writing the letter, I had the radio on. And just as I finished the letter, one of your songs came on. I think it was maybe something from Pictures and Exhibition. And the lyrics were, there's no end to my life, no beginning to my death. Death is life. And he said, those lyrics just struck me so hard. He said, I decided that I wouldn't do it, that I was not going to kill myself. Mm. He said, that was many years ago. He said, now I'm all right. I got cured, and I'm happily married, he said. But I had to tell you that story.
Fantastic.
And it was quite amazing, you know. It could have been anybody's song, but it just happened to be one that I'd written and recorded. And it is amazing how music weaves itself into people's life, because it's a spiritual thing. Music is a spiritual thing.
Since you're not finished with the autobiography, I assume there's not a title as yet.
I don't want to release the title just yet.
Okay.
But we will. We're going to make an announcement shortly about the book, and we'll make sure that you are the first to be told.
Oh, fantastic!
I will. We'll do. Well, maybe we'll do. You know, I don't know if you talk about books on your program, but
I do.
I'm happy to talk.
Quality
I'm happy
books.
To talk about it when it comes.
Outstanding.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to pretend it's anything high-minded. It really is just the story of my life. But, you know, it's quite an incredible story when it's viewed as a whole and you look at the way it unfolded. It's quite incredible.
Can't wait to read it. Anyway, I sidetracked myself. The Songs of a Lifetime, the tour, very personal and intimate. But then we have a chance also to spend some time with you backstage.
Well, yes, by all means, please do come back and say hello.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I say this is personal and it's intimate, it is both of those things, but please don't think it's dull or boring or just a guy sitting up there strumming a guitar, because that's not what it is. It'll be quite a colourful and exciting show to be a part of, and I think that's what I want it to be anyway. You never go with shows, you know, until you actually get and run them.
Right, yeah, when the tire hits the road.
Yeah, then you know.
Right.
Then you know. And that, you know, that's always what has thrilled me about live performances.
Now, I don't know if you want to say or not, will it be strictly you on stage?
I'm going to have an accompanist, because some of these things will just sound better with some accompaniment.
Okay.
And from time to time, I may have the odd guest or two come and appear with me.
Right. I'm sure some
will.
That
will be just for fun and just depending on, you know, who's in town that night, really.
Right. So yet another fun kind of factor to go in. This, I'm getting more and more excited about this.
Yeah, well, I hope that people will come and see. I think it will be an entertaining show that will touch some of the things that will have touched them in their lives, you know. I will be very surprised if we end that show and something during that show hasn't reached deep into someone's soul. I would be surprised. because he certainly did to my soul.
That's a huge statement.
Well, it is. It is because it's true. These songs are not just a rock concert. They're songs that affected my life, you know. And so to me, that means they were pretty damn important. And I think that they're not only my songs, you see.
Right,
they're songs that affected me by other people. And so, to that extent, I'm just a member of the public, you know. In that regard, me and the audience are one person. So what I like about this show is it's a change of perspective. At one moment, I'm the artist. The next moment, I'm part of the audience almost. Well, it has been a way.
Right, right. I'm just kind of wrapping my mind around this. This is, I don't recall anyone doing anything even remotely similar to this.
I hope it is groundbreaking. I'm certainly trying to make it so. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, talk too crazy about it, but I'm really putting a lot into it. It's just taken a lot of time to prepare, and it isn't just me going around with the guitar, humming a few tunes and leaving, you know. It's a lot will have gone into the show by the time it hits the boards.
Very good. Well, and it's not like you've not pulled off spectacular shows consistently from, 67 or 68 on. You've been there, done that, you've pulled it off. You're not just bragging from a place of never achieved anything. This is what you do.
I think the nuts of it, that I've always had respect for the audience. You know, they paid money, they're good money to come and see you perform. And you've got a duty in that regard to perform well. I also think that when people are good enough to buy your albums, when they buy your records, it's rather like, I look at a record as being like a check, you know, that you write out. Is when people buy my album, I owe them a live performance in a way. I owe them to come and play that record live because they bought that, you know, and it's only a record. And I think that in a way there's a duty of every artist to perform that music for the public that bought their record. So that's probably why I always put a lot into the live performance.
Now, do you have any...
In one way or the other, it's not always visible. It's not always there to be seen. A lot of this stuff really is what goes on behind the scenes to make it happen. But I'm not one of those people who just, you know, throws an amp on stage and jumps up and starts jamming.
And it's part of that veil between what happens on stage and off stage. You're kind of tearing that veil for us a little bit and giving us a peek.
I hope so. I hope that a lot of it will be entertaining because it will be like, well, it'll be like peeling back the veneer. It'll be like coming backstage at some of these things, or it'll be as if you were in the band and experiencing it from that standpoint.
So after this, I know you're very wrapped up and consumed with this at the moment. Do you have any plans after Songs of a Lifetime?
I'm going to be recording all through the summer. I've been putting an album together for a long time. It's a very big record. It's really two albums. One album is going to be orchestral recordings of all the acoustic songs I've done. I've done them symphonically. And so that I've been working on that for years, and I've just never found the right time to release it until now. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to put that record together with another album that I'm going to make during the summer, and it's going to be a kind of a totally new album of new material with the existing album that I've been working on. So it'll be a sort of combo record, a combination of things.
Very nice.
And I hope, a very entertaining album.
Sounds interesting. Oh, So you're going to do orchestra again. Just amazes me the kind of odd relationship in a way that you've had with orchestras over the years. For
it
better
is strange.
For worse.
It is a bit strange, but the reason that is, I'll put it in a nutshell for you, is that when, particularly when King Crimson started, we realized the need to be original. And most bands at that time, most rock bands, were taking their influence from America, from the blues, from country music, from jazz, some gospel, but all American music. And we decided that if we wanted to be different, maybe we should draw our roots from more European music. And so that's where that initial idea of looking back into European classical music came from.
And then prog rock was born.
In a way, it was. I think there was a lot of sort of squiffy prog rock, but I think anybody that was trying to make real progressive new music, a lot of that did have European music at its roots, certainly to begin with, you know. And it was just a vein of music that had been untapped, really.
It seems to me, in retrospect, to be such an obvious choice.
Me too.
I guess that's
why
you did it.
I'll tell you something. In those days, you would never get a young person buying a classical album. Nowadays, they're on every cell phone. You've got classical music at every sporting event, almost. You know, Fanfare for the Common Man, you've got opera, the three tenors. It's almost become a pop music, part of pop music, really. But that never would have happened, I don't think, unless bands like ELP would have come forward with things like pictures at an exhibition.
I'm quite sure I never would have purchased my classical version of Pictures at an Exhibition had you not led me down that path to begin with.
Well, I think you're probably right, because at the time we sold something over 3 million copies of the album Pictures at an Exhibition, and when we received the platinum record for it, we discovered that the sales of the original orchestral versions had quadrupled.
It stands to reason.
Yeah. People bought the rock version and then thought, I really like this piece of music. I'm going to get the original thing. And they went and they bought it.
I remember getting
it. And I think it opened up the door for a lot of people, especially young people, to say, look, classical music isn't just for the elitists. It isn't just for the them what knows who've had a good education. Classical music's for anyone who likes it. You could be as dumb as dirt and still like Bach. Look at me.
I wouldn't go that Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, funny, eh? But you're right, you know, it's a thing that, you know, a generation ago, classical music wasn't taught to the ordinary kids in school. It was only taught to the clever kids, the smart kids, you know.
Right.
They would have a classical music lesson, you know.
And you were very instrumental in kicking that door open.
I think, well, you certainly played a part in it. We weren't the only ones, maybe, but we played a part in it, and it was great. And what you said was right. It was timely. There it was. It was a door waiting to be kicked open.
Well, I'm sure thankful for you that you did that. That's looking forward to seeing you so much, and maybe sharing a little bit of my story with my wife there in particular on just what an impact that you've had in my life in such a positive way. And I'm just very excited about seeing you this, May 18th? We'll be seeing
good.
You
well,
at the Orpheum.
It's very kind of you to say so, and I look forward to seeing you there.
Very good. Well, you've always been more than generous with your time. I'm going to let you go, and I'll see you May 18th at the Orpheum. Let's see. You're also playing, May 17th in Ventura and May 19th in San Francisco. And then will you be booking any more beyond that, do you know?
Sorry, will I do what?
Booking any more concert tour or any more nights on this tour.
Oh, they're adding dates all the time. They'll be adding dates all the time.
Outstanding. Okay.
But we will keep you posted. And as I say, when the book, as soon as the book's available, I'll send it over to you. And then if you do want to talk, we can talk again.
Outstanding. Oh, all day long, every day.
I'll see you at the show.
Okay. Very good, Greg. Well, thank you so much. I'll see you then.
It's been a pleasure. Bye.
Okay. See you, mate.
Bye-bye. Bye.